After several failed Republican attempts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act this year, half of Americans now approve of the law. That's according to Gallup's annual November Health and Healthcare Survey conducted at the beginning of this month. It represents a modest decrease from the record highs of 55% in April. Despite the slight decline, the current approval rating for the law remains higher than all pre-2017 Gallup readings on that question. And that's where we'll start our conversation with Sarah Cliff. She's a senior policy correspondent at Vox. She is a health policy journalist who focuses on the Affordable Care Act and the effort to repeal Obamacare. Sarah is in Wisconsin at the UW-Madison as a journalist in residence this week. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, what do you make of the new Gallup findings that half of Americans can get behind the ACA?
So it's pretty reminiscent of a lot of polling we've had on the Affordable Care Act. Ever since the law passed in March 2010, Americans have been pretty divided on it. You don't see a lot of change. The approval ratings go up slightly, they go down slightly, but they don't actually change. And I think that's a little bit reflective of our country's politics right now, that a lot of people kind of see the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare as a proxy for their political views. And even though it was rolled out in 2014, millions have gained coverage, you haven't really seen public opinion change, except when the Affordable Care Act was under siege. As you mentioned, the highest approval ratings were this spring when Republicans were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And all of a sudden, it seemed that Americans valued it a little bit more, thought about, oh, wait a minute, maybe I do approve of this thing. But now that that debate is over, the threats are still there, but a little bit smaller. The approval ratings have gone down a little bit. They're still hovering a little higher than previous years, but, you know, 50% approval, it still shows that we are quite divided about this law that has been on the books for nearly 8 years now.
This open enrollment period ends December 15th. There were basically new numbers out 6 days ago saying nearly 2.3 million Americans had enrolled in a plan. What do you make of those enrollment numbers? What did they tell us so far?
So they're pretty high. Enrollment numbers are running far, far ahead of where we were this time last year. Right now, we've had 42% more signups at this point in enrollment than last year. In Wisconsin, it's 35% more, which is pretty in line with the national numbers. And so that is surprising. We thought, given that Donald Trump has cut a lot of the funding for the Affordable Care Act, cut the outreach funding, cut the advertising funding, that we'd see very low signups. The fact that they're running ahead of last year is surprising. That being said, the enrollment period is half as long as it was last year. So even though signups are running 42% ahead, it is not clear that the enrollment numbers will be higher or even meet the numbers from last year. So
because of a shorter window.
Right. So last year there were 90 days to sign up. This year there are 45 days. The enrollment period ends on December 15th instead of January 31st. So even though enrollment is running much higher than it was at this point last year, there's still this hurdle of the deadline coming much, much quicker.
And so here you are in Madison in this journalism residency for a week. You're going out in the field to shadow some navigators. And it's interesting. My thought in my head was, wow, there are still navigators who are out going out there and helping people enroll.
Yeah, they are still here. I mean, they got some pretty significant funding cuts under the Trump administration. So the group I'm going to be shadowing covering Wisconsin, last year they had 17 navigators helping people sign up for insurance. This year they have 11 navigators. So they've scaled back their staff. They're covering fewer counties. But, you know, I was talking to them yesterday, getting ready to go out to shadow them today, and they are seeing, you know, really quick pace of enrollment. They're seeing significant signups, even though they have less staff. So I was interested in heading out with them to see kind of what it looks like on the ground as they get, you know, within, 2 weeks of the end of open enrollment, how they're handling the higher volume with fewer people working on this.
If you're just joining us, we're with Sarah Cliff. She's a senior policy correspondent at Vox. She's a health policy journalist who focuses on the Affordable Care Act and the effort to repeal Obamacare. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the Affordable Care Act as it stands? What question do you have about the push to repeal the ACA? Do you get health insurance through the exchange? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah, let's turn to the U.S. Senate and this they failed at the full-fledged repeal effort earlier this year. And now Republicans are working to dismantle part of the ACA that you see as crucial. Remind us again what the individual mandate does.
So the individual mandate is the requirement that all Americans carry health insurance or pay a fine. The fine right now is $695 or 2% of your income, whichever is greater. And the point of this mandate is to get healthy people into the insurance pool. You generally expect someone with a lot of health insurance concerns who has a lot of medical needs, they're going to sign up for coverage. But if you just have sicker Americans in the insurance pool, that leads to really high premiums. So the individual mandate is meant to encourage, to nudge Americans into purchasing health insurance to help hold premiums down for the entire group of people signing up for the Affordable Care Act. So it has been the least popular part of the Affordable Care Act since Obamacare became law. It was challenged in a Supreme Court case in 2011, but ultimately upheld. And Republicans have long tried to repeal this part of the Affordable Care Act because it is so unpopular. The problem is, if you do repeal this, the Congressional Budget Office out in Washington, they estimate that 13 million people would lose health insurance. Essentially, premiums would go up and it would become unaffordable for many Americans to buy their coverage. So it is included in the Senate bill right now. The Senate tax reform bill includes a provision to repeal the individual mandate. We're still watching how that develops. The House version of the bill does not have this. We're expecting some votes in the Senate later this week. So it's still pretty up in the air, but it definitely shows that Republicans, they are not ready to give up the healthcare fight yet, even after working on full repeal for months and months and months. Every bill seems to become a healthcare bill at this point out in Washington.
Why would it be a logical move to put it in a tax plan?
So the one thing is it's unpopular. So you can, you know, tell people we repealed this really unpopular part of the Affordable Care Act. But probably the bigger thing is that it saves the government a lot of money if you repeal the individual mandate. If fewer people have health insurance, the government is going to spend less money subsidizing health insurance. So the CBO, they estimate, I think it's about that the government will save $300 billion over the course of a decade. That creates space to do larger tax cuts. It creates space to do the sorts of things that Republicans want to do in this tax bill. So it's partially about politics and partially about the puzzle pieces of tax reform, creating more space to do larger tax cuts by freeing up this money that the government's currently spending on Obamacare subsidies.
In February, President Trump spoke at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And let's take a listen to his position on the Affordable Care Act at CPAC.
2 years don't do anything. The Democrats will come to us and beg for help. They'll beg, and it's their problem. But it's not the right thing to do for the American people. It's not the right thing to do.
So, Sarah, is this a method of undermining the ACA balance, or what is he getting at?
So, and this is actually something that came up also in a tweet from President Trump over Thanksgiving, where he made the same idea that this is Democrats' problem, it's a disaster, and Democrats are going to own it. The polling we have doesn't seem to suggest that's true. Most Americans now say in polls from the Kaiser Family Foundation that they would hold President Trump and Congress accountable for any current problems with the Affordable Care Act. It is true that is a law that was signed by President Obama, but now President Trump is in office, and most voters say he's the person they would hold accountable. It's unclear exactly what the strategy is right here. You know, I think earlier this year, there were a lot of attempts to undermine the Affordable Care Act, and that played into the repeal attempts. You could say, oh, this law is going so poorly. They would point to counties where no insurance companies want to sell coverage and say, this is the reason we need to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It made more sense now. It makes less sense to me at this point, because there really is no live effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Republicans tried and tried and tried, and they just couldn't. So it's unclear what the strategy is at this point.
Opinions on the Affordable Care Act have been sharply polarized since the law passed without a single Republican yes vote in 2010. Compared with a year ago, more Democrats and independents now approve of the law, while Republican approval remains low. We're talking with Sarah Cliff. She's a senior policy correspondent at Vox and the host of The Impact. That's a weekly podcast that explores consequences that laws have on people's lives. You can join in this conversation about the ACA, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the Affordable Care Act as it stands? Are you in the exchange? Join us. We'll return after a news update. The Senate Republican plan to use the tax bill to repeal the federal requirement that Americans have health insurance coverage threatens to wreak havoc on insurance markets. The Los Angeles Times crunched the numbers and found that this would leave consumers in a number of states with either no options for coverage or health plans that are prohibitively expensive. We're discussing the ACA, where it stands this hour, with Sarah Cliff. She's a senior policy correspondent for Vox covering healthcare, and she's at UW-Madison all this week as a journalist in residence. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Should politicians allow the ACA to fall apart, or should they try to make the program successful? Join in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Saeed, who joins us in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's important to remember that the majority of the expansion of coverage that occurred by the expansion of Medicaid and not through the exchanges. The exchanges, which is what we're talking about here, is a very unique market. It's a market in which the government has been subsidizing both the producer and the purchaser, and then holding a gun by the mandate to the heads of people to mandate their purchase in that market. That is not, if you were selling any goods or services in that arrangement, that is a very pro-inflationary arrangement, and it is not one that supports innovation and creation of products that will create value for the customer.
Saeed, let's get Sarah to jump in here. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think you're certainly right that Medicaid expansion has been a huge, huge part of the Affordable Care Act, and much bigger than the drafters expected, that most people who have gained coverage through the Affordable Care Act have done so because in most states it expanded coverage in Medicaid to all Americans under 133% of the poverty line, which works out to about $15,000 for an individual. I believe there's a 33 states participating in the Medicaid expansion. Wisconsin is not one of those, although Wisconsin has a somewhat
Badger
unique
care. Mm-hmm.
Arrangement to provide an insurance option to everyone at every level of income. You know, in terms of the marketplaces, they are a unique market. They're a market that is very heavily subsidized by the government. And I think that's one of the reasons, even though the Trump administration is clearly no fan of this law, that the marketplaces have been able to survive. The programs are still subsidized. You can still get help paying your insurance premium. And that might be one of the explanations for why we're still seeing some decently robust enrollment in the exchanges.
Saeed, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Maureen, who joins us from Middleton. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, I have a 26-year-old who will be out of insurance. She's on our insurance, so she will be off of that March 3rd. Can I enroll in Obamacare for her? Well, she's in an apprenticeship, so she does not have insurance. She makes about $125 a week. And then can I take her off of that quickly and easily once she gets a job? Mm-hmm. It's regular, you know, paid.
Yes. The answer to all of that is yes. So when your daughter ages off of your health insurance, it'll trigger something known as a special enrollment period. Essentially, I think it's a 30-day period where she has lost her health insurance, so she gets to sign up outside of the normal enrollment period, and she can go to healthcare.gov. You can go to healthcare.gov, pick a plan, and decide to sign up for that plan. You can see, you know, you can go on healthcare.gov right now and get a sense of what plans are there, how much she would pay for coverage. If she, you know, depending on her income, she might be eligible for Badger Care here in Wisconsin. So I would certainly look into that option. And you can easily enroll in a new plan if you do switch to a job, if you get an offer of employment-based insurance that triggers another special enrollment period. So my advice would be definitely go onto healthcare.gov, look at your options. If you're finding it confusing, I would reach out to Covering Wisconsin. They are a navigator group that specializes in helping people out in situations like this one, and would be able to walk you through, you know, the ins and outs of signing up for coverage.
Maureen, thanks so much for calling in with that question. Let's go to Kevin now, who joins us from Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Kate. This is my first time calling with you at the helm, so you'll probably hear from me every once in a while. I want to ask your guest, because this is the umpteenth segment the show's had on Affordable Care Act. Why can't we just get to a single payer or some kind of somewhere along them lines? It's just, this whole thing's crazy. The Republicans, they don't want people to be taken care of. And I can speak from experience because I've had a couple of things. Hey, I'm on SSI Medicaid. And if I hadn't, had a heart attack back in July, and if I hadn't gotten the expert care that I got from the moment I called 911, I might not be talking to you right now. And if I had, and I've got another condition, which I won't go into detail with recently, but if I hadn't been able to see these doctors, I'd be hurting for certain right now.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. And Sarah, go ahead.
So there certainly is a growing movement in the Democratic Party to think about single payer, a healthcare system where there's one plan run by the government that all of us enroll in. I was actually just about a month ago, I traveled with Senator Bernie Sanders to Canada, where he was doing a learning tour of hospitals there. He has become the key advocate for single payer healthcare in the United States. He introduced a bill in the Senate about 3 months ago. And so there is certainly momentum growing behind this. I think a number of senators and voters look at our healthcare system. They think Obamacare was a step in the right direction, but that it's still too complicated. It's still much too messy, that we need a universal system similar to other countries. That being said, I still think we're quite a far ways off from getting there. I think it would be incredibly disruptive to move to a single payer system. And there is a lot of concern about making that sort of change. If you think of, there are about 200 million Americans who get their insurance at work. Mm-hmm. If you think of all of those people getting a cancellation notice saying you're on this government plan now, that's messy. You know, there were tens of thousands of cancellations with Obamacare. It became a huge political controversy. So I think there is, because we have gone down this path of an employer-sponsored healthcare system for over 60 years, it becomes even more challenging to create a system like Canada's system here.
We're talking with Sarah Cliff right now. She is a senior policy correspondent at Vox and the host of The Impact, a weekly podcast exploring the consequences that laws have on people's lives. Talking about the Affordable Care Act, where it goes next, you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the ACA? Have you seen your health care options change under the Affordable Care Act? Are you shopping for insurance right now on the ACA? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah, this tax bill also reaches into Medicare, the national federal program that brings health care to older Americans. What do we know about the context of the GOP, the tax bill, and where Medicare fits into this discussion about health care?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a roundabout connection to Medicare, but it's certainly one that matters. So right now, the tax bill that we've seen, it would increase the deficit. It would not pay for itself, essentially. There are too many tax cuts and not enough spending savings to balance out. One of the things that would trigger because of Senate rules are across-the-board budget cuts in the government. And that would work out to a cut in Medicare, along with other areas of the government. Now, it was not Republicans' intention to cut Medicare, they would argue. There's no provision in this tax bill that takes aim at the Medicare program. But at the same time, you would see, I believe it's $25 billion a year in cuts to Medicare that would be mandatory cuts because of the spending in the tax bill. So that is another factor that's in play here. It's a lot of different healthcare programs that get tied into what is supposedly a tax bill.
So how does that change the conversation then in the context of the ACA discussion?
I think it, you know, heightens the stakes of things that we're not just talking about the Affordable Care Act and people who get insurance there. We're not just talking about Medicaid. We're also talking about the Medicare program, which is generally very popular. Legislators tend to be pretty reticent to cut Medicare because it's been working. It's been in existence since 1965. The people who use it are generally very happy with their coverage. So it just creates another layer of issues and challenges in the healthcare space that come up in the Senate bill.
Let's go to Louise now, who joins us in La Crosse. Hi, Louise. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, good morning. I don't know if this is a relationship or not. My topic has to do with the fact that the Affordable Care Act did mandate the full payment and coverage for contraceptive products for women. And I recently saw a news report that abortion rates have declined in the United States. And I'm wondering if you're aware of that statistic and if you could draw any conclusions from those two pieces of information.
Yeah, so you're certainly right. The abortion rate and the teen pregnancy rate are both at an all-time low right now. They have been decreasing really, really steadily for the past 8 or 9 years. This is a topic I've covered a decent amount, and it's been a pretty unprecedented trend in public health. Usually, you know, you don't see really steep declines year after year, but that's exactly what you're seeing with abortions and teen pregnancy. And I think it is a multifaceted story. The Affordable Care Act is near certainly a part of it. One of the things it did is it required insurance companies to cover all forms of contraceptive with no cost sharing for the patient. So that meant anything from a birth control pills to IUDs, intrauterine devices, would be covered at no cost to the patient. And that near certainly has played a role in the declining abortion rate, the declining teen pregnancy rate. But this trend started before the Affordable Care Act. So it seems like there were other things at play that were already causing these declines. And then the ACA came in and ensured that those declines continued to happen. So I think it's part of a larger story about a big change we're seeing in pregnancy in the United States.
Louise, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Chris now, who joins us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi. What I thought would be good was if the employers that offer insurance, the larger employers that offer insurance to their employees, that if they have an employee that works less than the number of hours to get the insurance, that they pay a percentage according to the hours that they work. That way they wouldn't be hiring so many people and keeping them just under where they're available to get insurance. And if they were to pay this into, say, Badger Care or whatever, that would put an assistance to help cover the insurance and then take some of the pressure off the taxpayer.
Yeah, so I think you're talking about the Affordable Care Act's 30-hour-a-week threshold, and that is the point where an employer is required to provide health insurance to an employee or pay a fine to the federal government. They're basically saying if you have someone working for you full-time, you need to contribute and you need to help pay for that person's health insurance. And, you know, I think it's an interesting idea that you raise, you know, once someone goes down to $29 or 29 hours a week, why is that company completely off the hook? So we don't have a lot. We have a lot of anecdotal cases of companies making those sort of decisions of once this mandate came in, because before the Affordable Care Act, there was no mandate to provide insurance to employees. Most employers did that because it's a good way to recruit employees. It's a way to offer a benefit. It's tax advantaged, but there was no requirement. So we heard once the Affordable Care Act became law, anecdotes about businesses cutting employees back to 29 hours a week so they didn't have to pay for insurance. But the research we've seen, the academic research that looks at this on a larger scale, doesn't suggest it as a widespread challenge. It doesn't suggest this is happening a lot at a really high rate. But, you know, if you are that employee who gets cut back to 29 hours a week, it is very frustrating. And I think you raise an interesting point of, would there be a way to require companies to kick something in so it doesn't fall to the state that's providing Badger Care, to the federal government that's providing the insurance subsidies? The ACA doesn't have any mechanism like that. It has a very black and white line. So it means if you do move someone down to fewer hours, you are off the hook for providing insurance.
Have there been other workarounds, Sarah, that companies have used to work through what is going on with the ACA? Have the companies done other workarounds?
So I think you've seen, some companies, one interesting example is actually the grocery chain Trader Joe's, where they realized that their employees, because of their wages, would get really generous subsidies on the marketplaces. And so they actually stopped offering health insurance because they felt that their employees would get more generous coverage if they bought through the marketplace. And it was very controversial. I mean, no one is happy when their employer says, we're going to stop offering coverage. And they were not cutting back hours. Trader Joe's was going to pay this fine, which cost them less. And it speaks to the idea the last caller just raised. They saw a good opportunity to bring government dollars to their employees, and they took it, which is, I don't know, that's quite the incentive the government wanted. I don't think they wanted to encourage.
Not the intended outcome.
Exactly. So you see all sorts of things when you, the health insurance market, it's full of different incentives and different actors. And when you change the rules a little bit, you see a lot of behavior changing in response.
Chris, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Marvin now, who joins us from Vernon County. Hi, Marvin.
Morning. My question is, I got to get insurance starting January 1st because my policy I have now, I'm no longer going to have. My employer will pay 85% of my insurance, but since I'm the only employee, there's no way they can buy my insurance other than give me a bonus I'm paying taxes on. Is there any other way?
So I don't think so. I think you're right. If there's no group plan to buy into, you're probably going to buy through healthcare.gov. It sounds like what you're saying is that your employer is going to help pay whatever premium you're charged through healthcare.gov. And, you know, that arrangement could work out decently well, I think, you know, if they are going to pay 85% of the monthly premium, especially if you're getting some sort of subsidy, depending on your income, that could work out well for your employer and for yourself. I would remind you the deadline for enrollment is December 15th. So you certainly in the next 2 weeks want to get on healthcare.gov, search for a plan, and again, reach out to a navigator group covering Wisconsin if you're having trouble doing that.
Marvin, thanks so much for the call. Nearly 2.3 million Americans signed up for individual health coverage under the Affordable Care Act in the first several weeks of the open enrollment period that's underway. Signups in the first 18 days of this year's enrollment are well ahead of last year's pace, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The open enrollment period began November 1st. It runs, as Sarah said, to December 15th. The signups include the 39 states using the healthcare.gov platform. Sarah Cliff stays with us. She's a senior policy correspondent for Vox and covers healthcare policy. Your first person stories about health coverage and how you've been impacted, 800-642-1234. Do you get health insurance through the exchange? Does a shorter enrollment period impact your decisions about health coverage? Let's discuss after this latest news. Health plans like Medica and certain Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans expanded their individual insurance offerings in more states for 2018. Their moves come as Aetna, United Health Group, and Humana scaled back their ACA business after being unable to manage the costs of sick patients signing up for individual coverage. Meanwhile, over on Capitol Hill, at least a half dozen senators have raised concerns about the tax bill provision that would eliminate the Affordable Care Act requirement that most Americans have health insurance or pay a penalty. We're looking at all areas of where the ACA is playing out right now with a Vox senior policy correspondent. Sarah Cliff is here in the studio. Her journalism focuses on the Affordable Care Act and efforts to repeal the ACA. She's also the host of the new podcast, The Impact. What is your story on the ACA? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Sarah, what are the options looking like for people who want to get a plan on the exchange?
So there are options, but there are increasingly few options this year. One of the things we saw with all the tumult around repeal and replace and the efforts to wipe Obamacare off the books was insurance companies got a little bit skittish. And we've seen an increase in the number of counties that have just one health insurance plan selling coverage. So there are fewer options this year, but everyone does live in a place where there is an option of how robust of coverage you want to buy. If you want to buy a skimpier plan with less with lower premiums, or a more robust plan that's going to have lower copayments, lower deductibles for a higher premium, those choices are available to all Americans regardless of where you live, but you might just have one insurance company providing those plans. That's a pretty common situation this year.
But there is still coverage. There are still plans out there. We had heard reports of some counties not having any options. That is not the case?
That is not the case. So we did have kind of bald spots across the country pop up as insurance companies would quit the marketplace. But we saw other insurance companies who saw an opportunity to be the only health insurance plan in those areas jump into the marketplaces. So we've really seen a lot of the big brand name insurance companies, the ones you mentioned, Aetna, United, really pull out of the marketplaces. They feel like they understand the business of selling insurance to big companies way better than they understand the business of selling insurance to individuals. We've seen a lot of smaller insurance companies see an opportunity there. Insurance companies that often helped states manage their Medicaid programs, they've really jumped into the marketplaces and said, you know, we know this population that tends to be low income. We're used to working with individuals. So it's been a lot of tumult in the marketplaces. This is the fifth year, the fifth open enrollment period, and you've seen some of the big players come out, some of the smaller insurance companies come in. And luckily, we are in a situation where every county in the United States has at least one option. There is the ability to purchase coverage no matter where you live in the country.
Let's go to Chris, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hey, great show. Hey, I am a nurse here in Madison, and in the past 6 months, I betcha I have had at least one patient a month tell me that their hours have been cut back so they don't get health insurance. And now they don't have health insurance, and they have less income. And so it's not anecdotal. It's happening, and quite frequently. And I've heard that report from patients ever since the ACA was passed. Additionally, my insurance rates from my company-sponsored plan have gone up over 400% since the ACA was enacted. I don't believe it's a good law in any way, shape, or form.
So I agree with you. There certainly are people who are seeing their hours cut back, and that's a difficult situation. A lot of people who see their hours cut back, they might go on the marketplace, they still have access to insurance, but it might cost them as more, or their deductible might be a lot higher, their premiums might be higher. You know, the best research we have right now suggests this isn't widespread, but, you know, that's from a year or two ago. It's possible there have been changes in the market. So it is certainly true, and I don't want to discount the fact that some people are going through this experience, and it is possible there's been a change since researchers have taken a look at this issue. You know, in terms of premiums for people who get insurance at work.
Private, yeah. How is the ACA impacting private insurance?
So there is not a very strong connection between insurance at work and the ACA. The Affordable Care Act did have a few benefit mandates, things that employers were required to cover. The birth control that we talked about earlier, for example, is one of those requirements. But the Affordable Care Act didn't really change the insurance that employees get from their workplaces. Insurance premiums go up every year. They have gone up every year before the Affordable Care Act. They continue to go up every year after the Affordable Care Act. And the law does not seem to have much of an impact on the rates of insurance for people who get it at work. For, you know, people who are getting coverage on the marketplaces, there have been significant increases. You know, we've seen 2 years of double-digit premium increases for people who buy through healthcare.gov. The national premium increases for people who get insurance at work, they've actually been pretty low. It sounds like Chris might be in a bit of an outlier situation. The Kaiser Family Foundation does a study each year where they look at employer-sponsored coverage, and they find about 4 to 5% increases each year over the past year. That's down from double-digit increases about 5 or 6 years ago, but it's going up. And one of the things we're seeing is that even though premiums aren't going up, deductibles are rising really, really quickly. So one way that insurance companies are avoiding premium increases is increasing the deductibles, which is another shift of costs onto patients. So it feels a lot more expensive to have health insurance right now than it might have a few years ago.
Let's go to Bill, who is in River Falls. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding this commentary on just let insurance companies sell across state lines. And I'd like to hear your opinion on that. My understanding is that ultimately you can have a race to the bottom because one state can have almost zero regulations or zero minimum requirements. And so everybody is insurance out of, pick a state and you're forced to take it. But could you comment on that and add some clarity and some facts around it rather than rhetoric?
Yeah, so I think you actually got it very, very well. You explained it just the way that I would. So there is an idea that has floated around among Republicans that we should let insurance companies sell across state lines. Right now, insurance companies have to comply with the benefit mandates and rules set by their state regulators. So a good example is autism coverage or treatment for autism. Some states mandate this benefit, other states don't. And if you sell in a state that has that mandate, you need to provide that coverage. The idea of selling across state lines is that a plan could domicile in a state with very few regulations and still sell in a state that has a lot of benefit mandates. So they could presumably offer a much cheaper option. They would not have to comply with all the benefit mandates. They could offer a skimpy health insurance plan. And the argument that gets made by conservatives is that this would increase choice. It would let people who want those skimpy plans buy those skimpy plans. The challenge you run into there is, as you raised, Bill, is this idea of a race to the bottom, that you could end up with some really, really bare bones plans. And one of the things that's really unique about the health insurance market, it's not like other goods where, you know, if I buy a car and someone else buys a car, the price doesn't really change. It's just me and you making separate transactions. But health insurance markets are different. You know, if a lot of healthy people buy into that bare bones plan, all of a sudden the price for the more comprehensive plan, that skyrockets because the healthy people are choosing the bare bones plans. So there is a worry, you know, from Democrats, from liberals, that this would really decimate insurance markets. And this is one of the things the ACA, you know, specifically fought against. It included this set of 10 essential healthcare benefits to create more standardization across the market. But I think that's the key tension here is liberals and Democrats supporting more standardization, more comprehensive benefits, Republicans arguing for less standardization, more choice. But there are a lot of consequences when you let those bare bones plans back into the insurance markets.
Bill, thanks so much for calling in with that question. Sarah, getting a little bit philosophical here as we start to wrap up the hour, have the motivations changed since before the ACA implementation with where we are today with the Affordable Care Act?
So I think it was pretty clear, you know, when Democrats worked on the Affordable Care Act and worked to pass it in 2009 and 2010, the motivation was really expanding coverage, was getting more people into health insurance. And it's not clear that that is the goal of the Trump administration. I mean, they have, on the one hand, you have had President Trump, you know, as soon as he comes in office, talking about covering everyone and expanding coverage to everyone. But we really haven't seen that with any of the legislation he has supported, that congressional Republicans have supported. It, one of the things that, you know, I have not understood is what are actually the goals of the Republican efforts to repeal Obamacare. It is to get rid of Obamacare, but the then what part has always been a little bit murky. When I was covering Democrats, you know, they'd always have the same canned answer. Well, we want to expand coverage, and that's why they want to pass the Affordable Care Act. There was no clear summary of why Republicans, what the system that they wanted to replace the Affordable Care Act with, what it looked like. And I think that kind of lack of a philosophy, that lack of a goal, it really, it made it impossible for them to actually pass a bill that would repeal the Affordable Care Act.
It sounds like tax reform and thus, therefore, health care could be on the fast track in Congress with a Senate bill perhaps coming, a Senate vote coming this week. What are you watching for as we move forward this week and toward the end of the year?
So at this point, it's really all about the votes. It feels very similar to where we were on healthcare about 4 months ago, where right now there are two senators who say they can't support the Senate tax bill in its current form, including Wisconsin's Ron Johnson. And one more no vote, you know, that sinks the entire thing. They need, they have 52 members of the Senate, and they need 50 of those members to vote in favor of the bill for it to pass. And it reminds me of, you know, this dramatic moment on the Senate floor a few months ago where John McCain, the senator from Arizona, he walked up to the clerk and he put his thumbs down and he voted no. They are on that same sort of edge. So I think at this point, it's really all about the votes and all about whether they can get this past the finish line.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sarah Cliff is a senior policy correspondent for Vox. She covers the Affordable Care Act and the effort to repeal Obamacare as a health policy journalist. She's at UW-Madison all this week as a journalist in residence, and she'll be speaking tomorrow at an event at 6:30 at the Overture Center here in Madison. It's called Journalism, Ethics, and the Battle Over Healthcare. That event is tomorrow evening at 6:30. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation on the Affordable Care Act comes to you on the Ideas Network.